Senate Committee on Veterans Emergency Preparedness to come to order. Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you know, starting a year or two ago, I've been talking about sexualized violence in the military. And it is hidden away, and this type of violence is really, I think, immune to cure. Unfortunately, it's difficult to get people talking about this. People unfamiliar with men's sex violence against women don't even want to know it exists. It's ugly. And people that have experienced sex violence themselves, they too want to forget about it. So how do you get people talking now so that they can prevent it from happening? Well, it's awesome that the Oregon National Guard, in collaboration with Willamette University and the Rape Crisis Centers in Marion County, is hosting a Walk a Mile Inner Shoes event at the Salem Capitol Mall. It's going to be a week from this Saturday. It's going to be Saturday, April 18th, at, from noon to 3. And I would hope that if you're in town, I am going to be there, but I would love everyone on this committee to be there, because there's this old saying, you can't really understand another person's experience until you've walked a mile in their shoes. And it really asks men to literally walk 1 mile in women's high-heeled shoes. It's not easy walking in these shoes, but it's fun, and it gets the community to talk about something that's really difficult to talk about, which is gender relations and men's sexual violence against women. So I want to start spreading the word. I will probably do a remonstrance on this on the floor, and I think that this should be an annual event, which I think the National Guard's doing, but walk a mile in her shoes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. Colleagues, we're going to run through a series of real quick work sessions, and then we're going to move on to Senate Bill 808 and Senate Bill 94. I believe Rep. Boone is going to want to speak to those right there. We do have a legislative concept that we need to introduce, and then we have four bills you'll notice at the bottom of your page, which we heard last week and we agreed to move this week. So I'm going to open a work session for the for the possible introduction of committee measures. Madam Vice Chair.
This one?
Yes, ma'am.
Chair Boquist, I move that LC 4184, dated 4-3-2015, be introduced as a committee bill.
Madam Vice Chair Monis Anderson has moved that LC 4184, dated 4-13-2015, be introduced as a committee bill. If we do introduce this, colleagues, this is a concurrent resolution on an individual we discussed previously. If we introduce this, we'll ask the bill to be assigned back to us, and before the 10th, schedule a public hearing and a work session for it. Is there any other discussion? Is there any opposition, Madam Vice Chair? Seeing none, so ordered. With that, I'm going to close the work session on introduction of committee members and open a work session on SCR 7 and SB 17. Council, very quickly, will you explain both of these and explain their connection, which is why we're opening a double work session?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, SCR 7 and SB 717 are interrelated. They honor the same individual, that is memorializing Army Specialist John and Alexander Pelham. Both these measures were previously opened simultaneously and heard on the 31st of March. There's no revenue impact and no fiscal impact on the concurrent resolution. There is no revenue impact and a minimal, so no statement issued on Senate Bill 717. The difference is it's a better safe than sorry, covering the bases to enable the family members of the deceased to obtain a roadside memorial sign. There is currently before this assembly a bill that will streamline the process to obtain the roadside memorial signs, and it's still pending. So there shouldn't be any difficulty with its passage, but if there were, the family is covered by having both of these measures.
And then, Council, if I recall, if at the end of the session the two bills then will be deconflicted with each other, the House bill and Senate bill, correct?
That's correct. There won't be
I don't remember what we call that final bill, but we call it something.
Yes, and there won't be any conflict either way with or without the passage of the measure that fixes the process for the roadside memorials.
Okay, Madam Vice Chair.
Chair Boquist, I move SCR 7 to the floor with a B adopted recommendation.
Madam Vice Chair Monis Anderson moves SCR 7 to the floor with a B adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? Seeing none, so ordered. Madam Vice Chair.
Chair Bokus, I move Senate Bill 717 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Madam Vice Chair, Monis Anderson moves SB 717 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered. We're going to ask Senator Steiner Hayward, because these are in her district, to carry both of these bills. If not, Senator Olson, you'll be the alternate.
That's fine.
Thank you. With that, colleagues, I'm going to close the work session on 717 and 7, open a work session on SB 2763. Council, if you would, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2763, you'll recall it was heard on the 31st, allows public employers to compensate deployed employees. It stipulates that the amount shall not exceed their base salary on the date of their deployment, declares an emergency is effective on passage, there's no revenue impact, and an indeterminate fiscal statement issued. That's it.
And Council, just for the question, this is a complete permissive bill, correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
Chair Bolquist, I move House Bill 2763 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Madam Vice Chair Monis Anderson moves House Bill 2763 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any opposition? Seeing none, so ordered. I'll carry it. Close the work session on 2763 and open a work session on HGM 11.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Joint Memorial 11 urges Congress to improve delivery of care to rural veterans. This was previously heard last week, also March 31st. There's no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Chair Bokus, I move SJM 11 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Madam Vice Chair Monis Anderson moves SJM 11 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered. It's a health bill. Madam Vice Chair, would you carry it, please?
Absolutely. This topic came up when we were working on the Women's Task Force about trying to get health care. Why can't they just go see a regular doctor?
Good question for our congressional delegation. Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. With that, colleagues, I see that Representative Boone is here. She'll start coming up front. We're going to open simultaneously on SB 808 and SB 94 for the purpose of taking the representative's testimony. And then after that, we'll get back to everyone else. So if you have to leave, Representative, you can cover both bills or you can stay.
I'm staying.
Council, if you would, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 808 requires local emergency services agencies develop and maintain community resilience plans in consultation with private entities. It requires Department of Human Services coordinate and facilitate state and local community resilience planning, and it specifies the content of those plans. There are a couple of amendments. They are identical, the dash ones and the dash twos. They replace the content of the measure and create a task force on mass care and sheltering to be staffed by the Department of Human Services. They specify the composition and the object of the task force and require a report to the legislature by October 1st, 2018, and sunsets upon convening of the 2019 regular legislative session. Again, they are duplicates. That was because of a miscommunication between myself and Representative Boone about getting the request in timely. Senate Bill 94 requires local governments to plan for tsunami resilience of at-risk communities and requires rulemaking by the Land Conservation and Development Commission to that end. It has three amendments. The dash three is not yet summarized, but the dash one and the dash two, the dash one requires the Office of Emergency Management enter into a price agreement for heavy lift helicopter as specified in the measure. In the amendment, it permits local contracting agencies and local governments to contract a helicopter under that price agreement and adds an emergency clause and operative date of January 1st, 2016. The dash two amendment directs Oregon Homeland Security Council to identify certain energy infrastructure vulnerabilities, determine generator capacities, partner with others to make specified evaluations pertaining to emergency fuel, and make required recommendations. Again, just in the dash three, could have it summarized. Either.
Thank you. And colleagues, for the record, the 808 bill, these are all similar. The 808 bill, of course, is from Representative Boone, who put it forth for some concepts. And then the 94 bill came out of the joint proposal or the joint introduction back in January, if you remember, and it was kind of a placeholder for a series of concepts, which is why there's multiple concepts under the same thing. We'll be hearing these today and then figure out afterwards what we're going to do. Representative, you're up first.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee. And I take full responsibility for any misunderstanding between myself and Cheyenne Ross. It's been quite a last week and this week trying to keep this all together. So these bills are, and I also want to clear the water a little bit. Senate Bill 808 is Senator Mona Sanderson's bill, which is a combination of my HR 5 and hers. And since she's the senior person, she gets to use her title and her bill number. So it makes sense. And I guess I'll start with 808 and then hand it over to the real pros and the certified smart people who are sitting here beside me. And these came out of the recommendations of resilience plan, and this is the 808 is kind of a, without dubbing it with a name, the Oregon Resilience Plan 2.0 is what we called it for a while, and hopefully we will be able to set up a similar situation. The amendment number 3 is I'm on that one. The dash 3, anyway, sets up a similar task force, which these two gentlemen were on, and Mr. Rubin chaired, for that was the implementation of the Oregon Resilience Plan. This is the more human services side of things, housing, food, shelter, people, trauma, things like that, and so be slightly different. And so these were the Oregon Seismic Safety Policy Advisory Council, lovingly known as OSPAC, which these two, well, I don't think Mr. Rubin's a member, but Mr. Wilson is. He's one of the J's. He chairs it. And this group is a longstanding group that advises on seismic issues. And a true champion up here, too, longtime true champion, is Senator Courtney. And he's been our guru for a long time on these issues. So this all kind of comes together and moves forward on the plan for a piece that we thought needed a lot more attention after the fact. And then the 94 was part of one of the recommendations. That was, as you said, Chair, a placeholder for these issues. And so it has kind of a conglomerate of amendments with it, all of which we love. And there was one moment of, I had a little epiphany when I was listening to Senate Bill 85 the other day and thinking, how can we fund this or provide another avenue for them to get N94 with, and this deals with the tanks, fuel tanks. And not just to point out, but the ones in Linton pretty much stand out there along the river, and they are probably not very seismically safe right now. But we're looking for ways to do this. In Senate Bill 85, they have sort of an innovative way of funding these things, a public-private partnership. In Senate Bill 85, again, with seismic upgrades for historical buildings. And that they came together with that so that in that dash 3 amendment, which describes it, local governments, private entities, companies, groups, whatever, can go together on to create a special kind of funding or grant program or whatever they want, loans, to get these things done. And so we thought maybe that was an idea for this one, too. So I support them all. Any way we can get this thing going and off the ground. So I'm going to turn it over to my assistants here.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chair Boquist, members of the committee. My name is Jay Wilson. I'm the chairman of the Oregon Seismic Safety Policy Advisory Commission. We fully support Senate Bill 808 in its amended language for the sake of continuing the work that was delivered in the Oregon Resilience Plan in 2013, which focused on infrastructure and the continuity of community services for that infrastructure. But in the next steps of the final chapter, we recognized we hadn't dealt very much with human resilience and communities as a whole, and the social aspects of what this disaster is going to do. And so this was the impetus behind working with Senator Mona Sanderson and Representative Boone to get this particular bill submitted. And outside of going over the support we have for the way the task force was organized, similar to SB 33, I have a short presentation that I was looking forward to sharing with you, just to look at, you know, we've looked a lot at Japan over the past few years and the lessons that we've been able to learn there and glean from their experience. But I wanted to just quickly share, here at the 10-year anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, the kind of event we're trying to avoid in what we're characterizing now as a mass displacement event, where we expect fully tens of thousands of people in Oregon would be near instantly displaced, permanently displaced, especially in the tsunami zones. So as you know, the Oregon Resilience Plan was focused around saving lives, protecting our economy, and preserving our communities. And I think what we're trying to do here stays on track with that, for trying to keep people in their homes and in their employment base. Just looking at the tsunami area alone for a magnitude 9, the chart on the left shows the percentages of the coastal communities that are going to be affected. And in the box on the right from a 2007 study, even at the 20-year-old tsunami line, we're looking at almost 25,000 people who are going to be displaced on our coastline, who will not have a place to live and will need transitional housing in the months and years to come, similar to Japan, where they still have 250,000 people not in a home. They're in temporary housing. And so if we look back 10 years at how things have worked this is mostly from Mississippi, not New Orleans, but this is the way people who were displaced and working within the system there were struggling and basically operating in a makeshift way to put together a way to deal with all of those people. And I just want to look at what this looked like in the hours, days, and weeks and months that followed. And how can we put together a task force that gets out in front of this rather than waiting and reacting to it? As you can see, mass displacement in traditionally means FEMA trailers. In the initial hours and days, there was a lot of issues around the health of the people who were displaced. Besides immediate search and rescue, there were these triage centers set up. This was one of these is in an airport, but just there was a lack of planning and coordination of how to deal with all the injured people and the chronic medical conditions that resulted in people being out of their homes and losing their day-to-day level of services and care. And that's something we know is going to happen if you take these people out of their home situations here. In the weeks following, it was tent cities and managing all of the food and water supplies that are needed for people who can't get to where they are, where they live, and where they need to either go back to or reside in an emergency setting. The role of non-government organizations like the Salvation Army in mustering their efforts to help. But neighborhoods were severely affected. This is along the Mississippi coast, and this isn't unlike what we're going to face. And these are the people who are going to be permanently displaced and will instantly need a level of planning and coordination that's been put into place deliberatively. And the recovery for those neighborhoods is going to take a long time. Just looking at these pictures in Mississippi alone, it's going to take months and years for these to be able to come back, and the needs of these people are going to be paramount. We've already talked about infrastructure damage, but this is going to complicate our ability to roll out the level of support that these people are going to need. And infrastructure, for the most part, is going to have to be replaced, not repaired, and reinstalled and put back in very thoughtfully so that we don't go back in and reoccupy dangerous areas that will be more hazard-prone in the future. The same for utility damages. All of these interdependent services are going to complicate how we take care of all of these people. And one of the complicating factors, if you look at this picture, is restoring power also means, on the lower right hand, the power that's needed for the emergency workers who come in, who are from the National Guard and other places. They're going to need a similar level of support and provision just to be there to help people. And it makes this whole planning process for taking care of all these people very complicated. Schools also are an issue we know are going to be damaged. And likewise, as anchors for communities, our ability to keep people in their communities and keep the schools open and running is going to be something we have to plan for around this displacement issue. But the bigger issue, too, is also the businesses that are damaged and the loss of the livelihoods of the people, of why they stay in these communities. And if we can't keep people in their homes, how are we going to have employees report back to work and basically get the economies up and running again? These are the kind of signs that were along the Mississippi Gulf Coast with towns that had been cleared of people as they're trying to get gas stations open with no one who can work at them again because people have been displaced, and the struggle for just getting everything back up to speed again. And then also debris management. I put this here just because this is a complicating factor for all of the land that's going to be needed to do all of this work. And if we're trying to find places to put all of this damaged stuff, it's often, as I saw in Japan, it's going to compete with areas of where people can live, where staging areas can be. It's a big factor. And so my closing slide is, we can't afford to wait for after this disaster to have the task forces to talk about what to do. We need to start thinking about this now, and it's why we've asked for this task force to have a 2-year rather than a 1-year timeline so that we get it right the first time. And we have enough time to make the decisions, and especially to bring the government side down to talk to the community level so there's a reciprocal level of engagement with the stakeholders. So with that, I'll close my testimony.
Thanks. Chair Boquist, members of the committee, I'll offer my 2 cents on Senate Bill 94 first and then go to 808. 94 is one of the items that came out of the State Resilience Task Force. Sorry, my name is Jeff Rubin. I'm the Emergency Manager for Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue. I am also the either current or former Vice Chair of the Governor's Resilience Task Force, which we shortened to Oregon Resilience Task Force. We felt it was extremely important to focus on both using the best science available for tsunami development restriction, which is covered in a separate bill, and also providing as much discretion to local authorities as possible, which is where Senate Bill 94 comes in. I know with the various amendments, one of the more recent ones addresses specifically fuel storage, liquid fuel storage and transfer sites. We know that fuel is going to be one of our primary vulnerabilities, fuel and transportation, and that our few central fuel hubs in Oregon are extremely vulnerable. So the only thing I would add to what is already in the bill is while emergency power is extremely important for liquid fuel sites, a larger issue may simply be actual physical structural mitigation, because a lot of the sites are either not on the greatest ground or the structures themselves may not be sufficient, which means there may require the alternative of considering other sites. I can't comment on whether the potential for public-private partnerships would be sufficient for funding, but I agree it's certainly, you know, we need to try something. For Senate Bill 808, I did have a presentation. Shorten. Should have gone first. I would have had to remember to say my name. So Jay had a bunch of great pictures. If you ignore the license plates and the coastal life, the birds, those could just easily have been shots from Sandy after hitting New York. Same type of really large-scale destruction, displacement. A little better warning. We'd certainly learned some lessons in the 8 years between the two major events. But by chance, a pretty interesting research item came out last week from Drexel University and some public health professionals in Pennsylvania with that title, Are Human Service Agencies Ready for Disasters? Next, please. So what they did is they took a survey, 188 human service agencies, public, private, not-for-profit. Most were human social services-based. Some were healthcare-related. Several were a mix of the two. And the key is the populations that they serve. You look at that list, it could go much longer than that, but that gives you an idea. Vulnerable populations are always going to be vulnerable. People at the society's margins are always going to be more vulnerable to disasters. But the concept of mass care means it's everybody. It's not just the vulnerable populations. They're just amongst our highest priorities. Next, please. So in looking at, in this survey from the 188 agencies, looking at what some of the significant barriers were, some of them, it deals with funding, particularly the private sector funding. Some of it deals with infrastructure and equipment, you know, just equipment, basic communications, phone, radio, IT networks. But you look at the items on the top and the bottom in red, and those really go back to the essence of what the task force outline in Bill 808 could accomplish, that the lack of interagency coordination, the insufficient real-time information exchange, which usually doesn't have, I mean, you can improvise, but the more you have things set up in advance, the more likely things are going to work. And that last item, an unclear role definition, that's really one of the essential functions of organized planning, and it's not something that comes about in 5 minutes. So, you know, the idea of having a task force that is going to run longer than 1 year was absolutely critical, and it's part of what we recommended for the deliberations on this. Next, please. It's a broad scope. I mean, you look at what's in that bill. Any one of those bullets would be just huge, and obviously they're interconnected. You know, some of them, just the access to medical care alone, which is a daily concern, housing, a daily concern, becomes much more acute after a disaster. And the idea that we're trying to foster recovery, which is bringing people not just back to the way things were, but maybe recovering better in a more resilient fashion. The idea of having the task force is that we don't want to wait until something happens. We can always plan afterwards. It's a lot better to start looking at what we want to do in advance. Next, please. And recognizing that this is, you know, if this were easy or even moderately difficult, we probably would have had it done by now. It's not like we're the adults and everybody else has it figured out. This is really difficult. It's complex. You know, the idea of having a task force that would be around for enough time to build the connections, identify the critical vulnerabilities and gaps, and then determine what we need to move things forward. Is really essential. You know, we're laying the foundation for what we define as community resilience. And it's also worth pointing out that this would be a voluntary task force, so while there might be minimal expenses, you know, we're not talking about any kind of significant budgetary impact. The other thing I wanted to focus on is that last bullet. Even though this is based on Cascadia and the 808 recommendations technically don't connect to our task force recommendations, we were much more general in this. We don't need a major earthquake for us to see the benefits from this. For those of you who remember the 2007 storm, 2006 for Columbia County in particular on the coast, Vernonia, you know, we have mass displacement with much smaller, more localized events that are just as catastrophic and have just as large an impact on those communities. So this will provide much greater benefits than the rare Cascadia earthquake.
Thank you. And just for the record, I just remind everyone in the public and the colleagues that since 2005 and now, we have used the Cascadian 9080 earthquake simply as the planning model. As was brought out in testimony here, you have Vernonia floods, you have floods on the coast, we have all kinds of events that transpire, snowpack, all kinds of things that are all impacted by these sorts of issues. We just happen to be using the worst case scenario as the planning mechanism to build up to it. Madam Vice Chair, questions?
Well, you know, I want to thank Jay for involving me in this concept last fall, wasn't it? Because we didn't have a public, he had to describe to us, try to tell us what it was, and we met with Representative Greenleg after he had met with me to try to get some public health type people, human services oriented people involved in this, because we haven't really done that. And that's one thing in this amendment too. We wanted to make sure that people from human services, people from health services, housing services are at the table, because that's what we need. And so I want to thank you for doing that, and I think this is extremely important bill. Thank you.
Sarah Olson, any questions?
They're all important, all three of them. They're very good bills.
And Courtney, any questions? You have a question?
No, I want to make a comment, okay, if you don't mind.
Go.
All three bills are very important to us, and it's just pleasant to see that we are now looking to the future. Prepare for what's going to happen. We know what's going to happen. We just don't know when. But preparation is timely, and it's good that we have it. And this task force will be great, because when we have those smaller programs that happen like Vernonia, we can see how the whole system works and maybe even tweak it a little more to make it work better if we have the big one. Thank you for putting your time in.
I just wanted to comment briefly, too, on this concept, this kind of task force. It was very successful, the first one, for what it did, and it was a very broad group, brought down from a very broad group who did the plan originally. And I just want to stress that it was a lot of professional people, a lot of community involvement, health services, et cetera, housing, everything. And they will, when they're convened and they start meeting, they will be considering what's out there already as well. And there will be a lot of people that each one of these members of the, I didn't count them, but there's quite a few on the task force, what they each bring from their sector. And I think it's pretty amazing. We're not asking for any money to do this. And I know that that was an issue with some people, but they were very successful in what they were able to do in their own capacity and provide the product that they did. And if you remember, you got a copy of that report, and it was boiled down to 2 pages at the end, but very small print because we had a lot to put in it. And it was a difficult task to do that. So I give Jeff and Jay and the rest of the people who worked on that, just boiling it down to a 2-pager report to the legislature, and their continued interest. And a couple of them have even said they would like to be on this next task force, if possible. So their continuity would be, and their historical knowledge would be great. So thank you for considering this.
Great, thank you. Senator Courtney, any questions? Okay.
And we need to make sure that Representative Boone is acknowledged for always being the champion on these issues.
You're here.
Yeah.
Okay, so just so we don't have a fight here. Representative Boone, do you want the A1 amendment or the A2 amendment, since they're both identical? Which one would you like?
Oh, my God.
Pick one, Representative. You don't get anything.
Okay, how about A1? That sounds right. Like top of the pile.
So there we recognize her. Okay. She gets so close to A1. Thank you very much. We'll call the next panel up, which is Sharon Hoffer, Peggy Lynch, and Patty Snow. And again, we're on 808,
but she and I didn't,
which is the -1 or -2 amendments, which are exactly the same, or we are on SB 94-1-2-3.
Hi.
And I'll let you fight it out. Who wants to go first?
First, I just got here.
Chairman Boquist, members of the Senate Committee, my name is Sharon Hofer. I reside in Southeast Portland. I'm a public health nurse, and I am here today not representing any organization, but as a concerned citizen and community advocate. In the interest of full disclosure, I would like to say that my husband is Jay Wilson, who is the chair of OSPAC. I'm here today, though, as a public health nurse, and I'm here today to support passage of Senate Bill 808 that calls for mass care and shelter planning for Cascadia Subduction Zone, catastrophic earthquake and subsequent tsunami, an event that will result in the mass displacement of tens of thousands of Oregonians and visitors. There is planning that has started. It's been embarked here in Oregon by state agencies and community partners, and there are complete plans that have done in California and Texas for a catastrophic disaster. But those plans are contingent upon response from areas adjacent to the disaster zone where there is intact infrastructure. We are facing, in our catastrophic disaster, an area from the northernmost California to British Columbia, all the communities along the coastline, and the I-5 corridor. In addition to that, north of us, we have a more populous state that will be needing the same resources that we will be requiring here as in response. And so that, coupled with the interdependent networks of that make up our infrastructure, communications, transportation, fuel, gas, water, electricity, those systems will be destabilized. And as a result, the full access to basic life support mechanisms of shelter, food, clean water, and health care will be inaccessible to many Oregonians for days to weeks. And so we are asking for an ambitious, a robust effort in planning for mass care and shelter over a long period of time, modeled after the modeled after the Oregon Resilience Plan, which brings in collaborative effort of various partners and from multidisciplinary, from various backgrounds, and over a long period of time as well. And I'm going to stop here. Thank you so much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Peggy Lynch with the League of Women Voters of Oregon. My testimony is about Senate Bill 94, but before I go there, on Senate Bill 808, I'd like to share a couple of things. In full disclosure, my husband is an amateur radio operator who helped with the 1996 Vernonia floods, including in the health side, making sure that patients in Vernonia who were stuck away from their health care could talk to a doctor via amateur radio. The other comment I'd like to make is that recently, I happen to live in Benton County now, and our public health department recently did a resilience plan connected to a grant that they were given. So they have at least a first step related to the discussions that you had on Senate Bill 808. Now, to Senate Bill 94. The League of Women Voters is a grassroots, nonpartisan grassroots political organization that encourages the informed and active participation in government. We support the land use planning program with local implementation, and I hope that AOC and LOC hear that, because we believe that local implementation is important in this effort. So if, although the bill says requires, we're assuming that the local jurisdictions will have an opportunity to work on their hazard planning. The League has studied hazards planning and seismic risks. We have a number of positions, and you have our letter on OLIS, so I'm not going to go into that. But we this session have recognized the importance of Goal 7, natural hazards, as one of the top 10 statewide planning goals, and we have testified on a number of bills related to this issue, and this is but one of them. With the effects of our changing climate on our landscape becoming more and more serious, and the good work of Dogami in preparing tsunami inundation maps, it is time now to work together to develop the rules, tune the LCD sitting beside me, to guide our state and local governments as they address these serious public safety issues. The League has testified before LCDC on a number of times on this issue related to the increasing threats. They have taken some limited steps to assist coastal jurisdictions in relocating schools and providing for storage units for life-saving supplies in case of emergencies. Although considered during the development of their work plan, they have not done, they have not yet moved towards doing rulemaking on Goal 7. So we ask that you support Senate Bill 94 and pass it to the Senate with a due pass recommendation. We have no comments on the particular amendments that were added to the bill. Be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Boquist and members of the Commission. This is Patty Snow. I'm the Ocean and Coastal Services Division Manager with Department of Land Conservation and Development, and here regarding Senate Bill 94. I did want to mention that I just came from the other room where they were also talking about a rather similar bill, where I'm assuming if these go forward, they'll be combined at some point. One of the representatives in the other room was asking, well, what's DLCD doing with local governments in terms of the tsunami hazard on the coast? And did want to mention, just last year, we developed, with the help of a consultant, a land use planning guide called Preparing for a Cascadia Subduction Zone Tsunami, a land use guide for Oregon coastal communities, and it's really the first like it in the world as far as we could find out. We were looking worldwide for examples, and a number of our Pacific Island compatriots are very interested in this as well because they haven't seen anything like this before either. And so we have started to work. We're talking to any local government that will listen when they're actually are paying attention, and Clatsop County has started to work with us right now. They're working with us. They're the first county that will be actually working to adopt provisions of this into their plan, and so we're really happy about that. And we're talking to a number of other cities and counties as well, but that's the first one. We actually did have a little bit of coastal zone management money that we were able to provide Clatsop County to help them do that. So with that, did want to mention that we're very, very interested in working with local governments to address the tsunami hazards in their plan. I do have some testimony that I'll provide to the committee administrator afterwards, but So we basically, as you know, this the bill would direct us to enact rules. And so based on our experience in developing the land use guide and through our early work with coastal communities, we realized that this rulemaking would be complex. And we then the needs for addressing the tsunami hazard will vary among the local jurisdictions. Seaside, for example, as I understand it, 90% of their dwellings are within an inundation zone. Rockaway Beach is another example where they have extreme hazard from tsunamis. Other coastal jurisdictions wouldn't be as adversely affected as those two, for example. So we want to be careful when we do rulemaking that it's sensitive to the needs of the jurisdictions. And what we're thinking is that over the next 12 to 18 months, working with local governments like Clatsop County, we'll get a lot better feeling for how does it work implementing these, because these haven't been tested necessarily, because it is new. It's just been developed. It's not like we took a guide from another part of the country that it didn't exist before. So that is one recommendation that we would make, is that we would prefer to do that rulemaking after we've had the opportunity to work with these guidelines with local governments. One thing we also mentioned in the other hearing is that the House bill does include an as of yet identified appropriation for local governments, but we think that would be important for local governments to actually be able to implement changes to their plan to address the tsunami hazard. And happy to answer any questions you might have.
I just have one clarifying question for LCDC. Mm-hmm. Is there something in the original body of 94 that you need amended to make sure that you have the appropriate timelines? Or just don't lean on you guys?
We didn't have any specific wording recommendations at this point.
Thank you. Madam Vice Chair?
Well, so it's put on the record. I want to make sure. I was going to ask the same question. Do we need an amendment? But if we have it on the record, that it is intent that you would want to meet with the local governments to get their feedback before writing the rules. Okay.
And Madam Vice Chair, I would assume that we'd probably have a longer time than normal, because no one's ever written rules for these things.
Right.
And, of course, while they are statewide, they only affect the local counties along the coast and a little bit up the Columbia River. So I would think more latitude is going to be required to the normal rulemaking process than other rules we make at LCDC.
Okay. And then, of course, I want to acknowledge that Sharon is a public health nurse. Very important people, okay? And she was a part of the three meetings that I had with Jay, or two of the three meetings that I had with Jay. And it's sort of nice to have some public health people passionate about this issue, because we could be doing more.
Mr. Chair, let me comment related to the broad rulemaking. Having been involved in DLCD rulemaking in the past, I can tell you that they have a very good reputation of providing a broad range of interests focused on the issues about which they do rulemaking. So I feel very comfortable that once they do rulemaking, that local governments, particularly the local governments that need to be at the table, will be at the table, as well as private citizens and businesses and others that would need to be a part of this discussion.
Yeah, and I appreciate it. I do think the key point is this is not. This is something not normally something we plan for and we've never planned for before, so to speak. So this is something kind of new and broad.
Absolutely.
And, you know, in this committee of doom and gloom, we get used to these things. And I'm sure that, you know, Jay and his wife probably have these doom and gloom discussions just like we have in this committee. We're known as the Committee of Doom and Gloom. Senator Olson, any comments?
No, that's too down for me. I'm just going to...
Right. Sir, thank you very much, ladies. Is there anyone else that wants to come up, since we've had the list up here a minute, and testify on 808 or SB 94? Colleagues, I would ask you that, come on, please come on. While they are coming up here, keep in mind that we have a base bill in 94 and an A1, A2, and A3 amendments. I'll need your input in the next couple of days so we can figure out how to proceed. And speaking of proceeding.
Yeah, Chair Boquist, I'm Mark Nystrom. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. I apologize for being late. I was over in the other committee. Really brief comment. my county planners wanted to let everyone know that a lot of the tsunami planning is happening. They do the FEMA National Hazard Mitigation Plan, and they really just want to look forward to, in both of these bills, look forward to working and participating as volunteering members of the group. And we, I really appreciate hearing LCDC saying that they want to reach out to our local communities and work with us. But we are obviously in favor of working forward on these bills. And we do appreciate the comment about some financial assistance for the counties going forward.
Always appreciated.
Yep.
And again, for the record, I do know, because we have looked at some of these plans, that all the coastal counties and the county governments have been working on this now for years, not decades, but years. And now we're trying to move forward and consolidate and get a more comprehensive plan across the board. Madam Vice Chair, any questions?
No.
Senator Olson?
I don't have any questions, but I want to comment on the bill.
Okay, just one question. Thank you very much.
Thank
Please
you.
Comment.
On Senate Bill 94, the dash one, Representative Boone, myself, Senator Roblin, and Representative Widener, worked on this to make certain that we had additional tools in the toolbox, if you will, to put the heavy lift helicopters in there, to make them available to take equipment, personnel, and fuel, communications, whatever, over to the inundated zones. And that's why the Dash 1 amendment is in there. That's why I want to remind you, we have 5 of 7 heavy lift helicopters in the world in our state, and I think it would behoove us to take advantage of them. That's why that open-ended contract is there. Mm-hmm. Same as what's used for the Forest Service when they're fighting fires.
Thanks.
Mr. Chair,
please.
Just to follow up on that, how much does it says here a heavy lifter helicopter cost? Are we talking millions?
No.
They're talking about per hour. Standby contract per hour.
Oh, a contract per hour.
Yeah, you have standby contracts. We do this for the forestry, so on and so forth.
Oh,
in fact,
yes.
We have other,
okay.
ODOT has standby contracts that are basically, they're like an IDIQ, if you follow that.
Okay.
It's indefinite quantity delivery, which means you don't pay anything up front. You have a standby agreement. It's slightly better than being able to call them up on the phone, because the phone might not work. So this time we'll know their contract works, and they'll just fly over. I can, having been in that business, I can assure you that they are multiple thousands of dollars per hour.
Oh,
more
okay.
than multiple thousands.
Really?
But they also carry 20,000 pounds of material at one time.
And then another follow-up. At least in the Dash 1s, I haven't really read them, but the Dash 1s, where is the Office of Emergency Management? Is there a representative from them? Have they been included in? It says that the Office of Emergency Management shall adopt rules, and here we're talking about LCDC adopting rules, but in the Dash 1s, it's the Office of Emergency Management. And I just wanted to know if they've been included. Maybe Jay and Debbie can come up just to.
I can answer that they
yeah,
have been.
Yeah, can you? Oh, they
yeah.
have been.
They have been.
Okay.
And Mr. Stuckey and I have met many times. We've met at the different places.
Oh, good. Okay.
And they will provide the rules for the contracts for the heavy lift helicopters, not for the land or anything like that.
Okay.
Just to recommend, if I should, the three of them were sitting back there not more than 5 minutes ago, and then left.
Well, I just started reading the amendments now.
They are also the oversight. Mr. Stuckey is also the legislative point of contact for the Oregon Homeland Security Council, which I sit
okay,
on.
Which is in the Dash 2s.
And is in the Dash 3s.
And are they in the Dash 3s? Okay, let me just pull that up. Yes, okay. So, and I know I've met with them, and I think they were all on board.
Correct, and the Dash 3
I just thought it would be nice to have them. Right. Say yes, they're on board.
And also in the work group we're doing in terms of trying to figure out future fuel access, the Dash 3 has been discussed in some in that work group, and Mr. Stuckey or his colleagues have been in that work group too. I would put on the record, though, that we probably do need to have them next week if we're going to move these bills
yeah.
to discuss these just to make
sure. Because I know they've met with me, Mr. Chair, on the amendment, particularly the amendment for 808. But it would be nice to have them on the record.
Okay. Senator Carter, any comments? Okay, colleagues, we'll circle back around with you on everybody on the primary bill and the 1 through 3, and then we'll close the loop with with OEM and the Homeland Security Council, which Mr. Stuckey is the representative for the Adjutant General to that, too. Seeing no one else to sign, we're going to close the public hearings on SB 94 and SB 808, and we're going to open a public hearing on SCR 12. I noticed there's someone from Deschutes here, and that is Robert Winson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, SCR 12 memorializes U.S. Marine Lance Corporal Nathan Winson.
Mr. Winson?
Mr. Winson? Please check on the morning, sir.
Okay. He's coming up.
Which one are we on now?
SCR 12.
My name is Robert Windsor. I'm the proud father of Lance Corporal Nathan Windsor. My son wanted to make a difference, and he joined the Marine Corps in 2005. He took great pride in being a Marine and serving his country. He was a point man for the 3rd Squad of his platoon, Gulf 27, out of 29 Palms, California. His sergeant chose him for the point man of the 1st Squad because he had very good combat instincts and he could always tell when something wasn't quite right. On March 11th of 2007, his platoon was on the second day of a three-day operation. His platoon went in hot and fast to a well-known insurgent hangout, and the Marines had been there about an hour interrogating detainees and searching for weapons caches. In the time that the Marines had been there, Al-Qaeda had set up 6 to 8 machine gun positions in a semicircle around the platoon, waiting for the right time to slaughter the whole platoon. My son had went to the back of a Humvee to retrieve a piece of equipment when his combat instincts kicked in and he could tell that something wasn't right. An Al-Qaeda sniper was watching for anyone that would give their ambush away, and he took a shot at my son. Lance Corporal Nathan Windsor was the only casualty that day, a day that very well could have had many, many more casualties. If Nathan had not given away the ambush, that could have been a very deadly day for America. My son took a bullet for freedom. And Lord knows I wished I could have taken that bullet for my son 1,000 times over. Nathan and the other service members who have put themselves in harm's way certainly are deserving of notice that indeed they did make a difference. Having a stretch of highway named after my son is a noble cause and a great honor, and certainly a way to make certain that Nathan and his brothers and sisters who have made the ultimate sacrifice will not be forgotten. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Windsor, and I can understand your position. Yeah. I luckily haven't lost any of my 6 children, even though multiple of them served. I unfortunately, as a commander on the ground, has had to make that phone call to parents far too many times.
Yeah.
And my condolences with you, Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you so much for coming and sharing the story.
Thank you.
Thank you. And for the record, we have a public hearing 1 week, and then we schedule for a work session. This will be scheduled for a work session next week on Tuesday. And I see Senator Canope and Senator Roblin are the two sponsors here. And we'll ask one of the two of them to carry the bill.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Colleagues? Comments. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Concurrent Resolution 12, and we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 775. Council, if you would, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 775, it makes pre-disaster measures taken to improve resilience inadmissible as evidence of negligence, declares emergency as effective on passage. I don't believe there's anyone signed up.
Okay, thank you. Colleagues, 775, and there's no one signed up here. This is a committee bill. I find it intriguing, so I'll have to reach out to the Trial Lawyers Association myself here. This is a bill that's actually come up in multiple sessions, and the committee's actually brought forth before, and it has to do with identifying issues to enhance planning. There's been the fear expressed, I think, to this committee multiple times in which larger corporations and entities and individuals that are involved in the resilience planning have been slightly fearful of coming forth and saying, okay, here's the problem we have, and we want to work with government to correct it, and they've been fearful of their liability. I do find it odd because we've had immense opposition to this bill for three sessions in a row, and now there's nobody here signed up. I would ask if there's anybody that's out in the Resilience Task Force that's familiar with this issue that'd like to come forward. If you would, Jay.
I'm going to mention this to Jeff. I'm talking to 775.
And the reason, again, colleague, this has been an ongoing planning obstacle that we've heard multiple times before. But as with anything else in this bill, once you introduce it four or five times, it kind of goes away and finally gets passed. And Jay, you might be able to address this issue too, because this actually it's been raised by I think by you before.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Boquist, members of the committee. When we had the task force in session, there were a number of members of the Public Utility Commission and private utilities that were very concerned about where the resilience planning efforts were going around requiring these utilities to have these vulnerability assessments and disclosure of that vulnerability that would make them liable if they were to have an earthquake and they hadn't completed these repairs as of yet. And one thing I tried to assure them that OSPAC wasn't trying to regulate them. We maintained that we wanted to continue to work as we had through the setup that the PUC has. And frankly, we couldn't understand the sensitivity that was involved because so many other hospitals and other types of private public organizations are required to do these same very things. But I guess I've had a couple of conversations on a national level with folks in the energy sector, and the way that it was expressed to me, at least, is because of the laws that regulate them, they have a hard time investing in monies in advance without having an ability to raise their rates. They've got some things that bind them or tie their hands. This was the reasoning that was told to me is why they're sensitive about this, and it's that's the only account that I can say here on the record that at least helps me appreciate why they're trying to say it, although I don't necessarily think we should take away their liability. You know, the ruling we had from the Attorney General was that the negligence clauses that we currently abide by would suffice.
Do you want to state your name again for the record?
My name is Jay Wilson, as the chair of OSPAC.
And I would mention that we actually this issue was raised in the fuel work group we had, and by yep. I think every major entity around the table, which included some of those you just mentioned and a whole bunch more that represented other fueling issues.
My name is Jeff Rubin, as the vice chair of the Working Resilience Task Force, Chair Boquist and committee members. We went over this a lot on the task force, and our final decision was to leave it out of our recommendations. We were not recommending for or against. We were simply not taking a position, in large part because, as Jay pointed out, they're not the only ones in this situation. We did think it was worth recommending, and it was in our report that utilities should be able to recover mitigation costs, costs that they incurred improving the system through rate increases, through the normal process that they would do that, through the PUC, but that was separate from the liability issue. I can certainly offer other examples. You know, NYU Langone, the hospital that got flooded in Sandy, they were under the exact same circumstance. Hospitals all over the country had done a series of vulnerability analyses after both Tropical Storm Allison flooded the Texas Medical Center in 2001 and after Katrina 2005, and they realized, you know, we've identified these problems. We have not had the funding yet to fix them, but the fact that they identified them is what allowed NYU Langone to evacuate in advance of Sandy hitting.
Mm. So there's precautionary things you can use then to do this.
Same. You know, City of Seattle, when they went through their huge seismic assessment as part of Project Impact back in late 90s and early part of 2000, they went through a series that identified hundreds, if not thousands, of vulnerabilities in public buildings and schools. They realized they couldn't do all the mitigation, but for instance, by draining the old-style heavy water tanks on the roofs of some of the school buildings, they could at least take the load off so that when they had the earthquake, the roofs buckled, but because they didn't have the load, they didn't collapse, and they figured that probably saved a lot of school kids and as well as the infrastructure in the Nisqually quake of February 2001.
Right, and I recall it took us a long time to even get one of the cell companies to come testify before the committee because they didn't want to express any issue of liability. And my thanks to Verizon, who, of course, has a large federal contract to do this planning, but they did come before us. Committee members, any comments?
So I'd like to know, I don't see a reason to go further with this bill.
I think I'd like to reach out to the Trial Lawyers Association and see if there's some reason. Because we heard the other side. We've heard two opinions from the Attorney General conflicting each other, and then we've heard the opinions of trying to get it. And the biggest issue we're having right now is basically the utilities and the fuel companies worried about liability. And, of course, being from up there, you could realize is if the fuel plant melted down out at the Portland Airport next year, people would be worried about liability. So. Okay, thank you very much. With that, we're going to close the public hearing on SB 775 and open a public hearing on SB 778. Councilor Hewitt, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 778 requires new construction of essential facilities, hazardous facilities, major structures, and special occupancy structures located in identified tsunami inundation zones to comply with State Department of Geology and Mineral Industries recommendations to mitigate risks to occupants prior to final approval from design plans by building officials. It prohibits such construction if Dogami determines that no available mitigation method is adequate, exempts Dogami determinations from the definition of land use decision for purposes of Oregon's land use laws, changes the number of occupants required to make adult education buildings subject to seismic evaluation by Dogami. The current threshold is 500. There's a blank in the bill to modify that number.
And we have two people from Dogami, and then Jay has signed up again, too. And, colleagues, the issue that's raised with this is I think some of you, we've talked on the sides, is we have some, for a better word, public infrastructure proposals that are actually in the inundation zones in various places. And the intent of 778 is actually just to raise the question we need to be aware that before we use public dollars and put it in an inundation zone that there might be problems. I'm not sure the bill goes anywhere, but we will let Dogami present his case first, and then Jay.
Chair Broquist, thank you. Committee members, I'm Richard Riggs of the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. I'm the assistant director there, and with me is George Priest from our Newport field office. Thank you for allowing us to testify on the bill. Dogami takes no position on this bill, and we would like to review existing regulations and comment on what we see as potential consequences and costs. Since 1995, the passage of Senate Bill 379, Dogami has had a statutory role in the regulation and development of tsunami inundation zone. The governing board of our department, of our agency, establishes the boundaries of the tsunami inundation zone by rule, and certain essential facilities defined by statute are prohibited from being constructed in the designated inundation zones. Developers of other types of high occupancy and hazardous facilities specified in statute must consult with our department about tsunami mitigation measures before obtaining a building permit. The developer, however, is not required to act on our recommendations. Some facilities, chiefly those that are water-dependent facilities like docks, are exempt. For essential facilities that are prohibited by statute from being sited in the inundation zone, our governing board may grant exceptions through an application or review process, which includes a public hearing. Since 1995, there have been 14 instances in which Dogami has been contacted about developments within that inundation zone. In those 14 instances, seven of those the developer has been required to consult with our agency, and there have been no requests for exceptions. That is the extent of my testimony on the bill today. I'm happy to take any questions if there are any. He's here as technical backup if there's any.
We'll come back to that. Jack.
Good afternoon, Chair Boquist, members of the committee. from the perspective of OSPAC, and having traveled three times now professionally to the tsunami inundation areas of Japan, certainly I support the intent of this bill in the efforts to improve our ability to address the critical facilities and locating facilities inside the tsunami inundation area. There are a lot of lessons that I've taken from the recent work that's gone on in Gold Beach with the hospital, and I'm not being critical of the nature of how that hospital is going in based on the needs of the community. But one of the things that stuck with me after working in that situation for a while was hearing that the community struggled with all of the competing demands. All the competing demands that they've had to work with other state agencies, with the fire marshal's office, with Dogami, with land conservation and development, with building codes that sometimes don't tie together. And the main thing that I see when I read this is that I just would encourage, for the sake of the local communities, that we coordinate with between our state agencies better with their respective roles that are very stovepiped, that that I feel like we can do a much better job as a state working collaboratively in advance of these types of developments, even in the planning stages, so that we don't get to the point where we're having to deny a proposed development at some late phase of the stage because we have adequate zoning, because we've adopted the new tsunami lines, because the building codes for adequate development for earthquake and tsunami are in place and have been adopted. And so I feel like there's a lot of groundwork that we still need to do to implement much more of a coordinated, facilitated process, similar to what DLCD was testifying about earlier, but that was one piece of all of this, so that the community has, we've got their back when they're trying to make these kinds of decisions. And so while I agree with the intent, my approach here has basically been neutral, too, because I think there's more devil in the details that need to be worked out if this is going to be an improvement on what I think is a current law with a lot of loopholes in it.
I think Seaside built their high school up above the tsunami zone.
Walport.
Was it Walport?
They recently rebuilt a new one on a hill.
Walport, okay. But then I heard of another situation of a hospital or something, and the costs were so outlandish that they decided not to move it, but just to leave it in the same area. I mean, and it's too bad that we don't have a structure, especially for hospitals and schools that are in a tsunami zone, that there couldn't be assistance or good loan rates or whatever to build outside of a tsunami zone, or at least at a higher level so that they're not impacted. But no work has really, this bill would address those types of things, or?
Well, from my understanding, the current law requires a developer to consult with the Department of Geology based on the hazard zonation, and that Dogami would offer suggested mitigations that they could take, but it's all basically voluntary, and there's no regulatory authority that Dogami has to make them abide by that, and that's where the current law doesn't really have any teeth in it in terms of how we manage this. And I know there's concerns about the state imposing this on local jurisdictions versus locals having the ability to make these decisions themselves, but I figure, my opinion is, if we had a better way for all of the state agencies that apply these laws and rules in a uniform way collectively in advance of this kind of decision making, it would give these communities a much better framework for making those decisions instead of having to go it alone, which is what I think happened with the hospital. That's what I was told directly, at least.
Okay. No, I just feel that it's going to happen. And any big major building should really take this into account. But again, you're coming down to cost and no one with a passion to really say, let's do this.
I have a question for both Dagami and for you, Jay. Is then we just heard earlier a bill in which we're trying to implement, we're actually adding to the land use planning standards, right? Is that a good first step in trying to do that, is to work through that process? Because you're saying, as we know, this bill isn't ready for prime time, so the people that are worried it's going to pass, they can rest a little bit at ease. But the issue comes back again to when Dagami makes the recommendation, you know, how binding is the recommendation? And the second thing at our level is we're going to look at a capital construction project this session in which that project is in the inundation zone. And the question is, and my question, I guess, to both Dagami is the first step really maybe to do the land use planning in coordination with LCDC and the counties and then get that framework in? Thoughts?
So we are not builders. We are not construction managers. We are people that again, Richard Riggs from Dagami. Our staff develops the inundation zone mapping, tells you where the water is going to come in, go out. And I do believe there are other agencies that are better equipped to deal with setting these type of rules than our agency.
And my insight, at least, comes from, again, what I witnessed in Japan. And what I see there now, 4 years later, are the kinds of 5 to 10 year recovery plans that they're implementing, where they're pulling back their communities out of the zone so that the residential areas, the major economic areas, the government facilities are on high ground. What's residing down along the waterfronts are primarily sea-based industries, fishing, some tourism. But you know, they've had to rejigger completely their land use and zoning so that they're not in harm's way again in the future and that people aren't displaced again. And what I think we should be talking about is that kind of visioning process on our coast now so that our hazard mitigation plans, our comprehensive plans, our recovery plans that we have in advance all have a direction they're moving in that's common. So that every step, every new water treatment plant, every new school, it's meeting a long-term goal of getting out of that danger zone so that it won't be obliterated and that it'll be there for the people when they need it. I know you'll never get it all done in advance, but at least if we could put that kind of target and then everything going towards that target supports that. It's pre-disaster recovery planning through the economic development, comprehensive planning. There's a framework coming on this from the National Institutes of Standards and Technology later this summer that I'm actually a member of to help communities facilitate this. So I'd like to think that what you're asking for is it's on the way as a process. Mm-hmm. But to legislate it right now, I think it really means that a lot of the state agencies that apply the laws and the rules need to be much more coordinated in how it reaches the ground at the local level.
Yeah, well, we certainly need to get much more coordinated, but we've also been at this a decade, too. I do have an inundation question. Is the Marine Science Center in the inundation zone in Newport?
Yes, it is.
And please expand. The scientist.
Name.
Well, it's...
Your name, please.
My name is Dr. George Priest with the Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. And Chair Boquist, the OSU proposed facility is definitely in the zone. It's in all the zones. It's quite low. And the site is on hydraulic fill within Yaquina Bay. So it's subject to both seismic and tsunami hazards. And flow depths, estimated flow depths vary according to which tsunami model you use. But, you know, definitely it is in all the inundation zones.
Thank you. Any questions, Commissioner Roberts? Thank you. Next panel is Greg Wasson, Jeff, and Aaron Doyle. I guess we'll let ladies go first.
Thank you, Chair Boquist. Members of the committee, for the record, Aaron Doyle on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. On a general comment, reaching back to Senate Bill 94 and this one, and there's about, depending upon how you count them, 7 to 9 other bills on natural hazard mitigation planning. The cities are looking for all the assistance they can get. But when it comes to the terms of Senate Bill 778, we are concerned about having Dogami left in charge. Not because we don't think that they're not experts at what they're talking about. We need their expertise. We need them to have constantly updating us to provide us with the information that we need. But we do have a land use planning system that for some of our communities puts the entire community and its UGB within the inundation zone potentially. It would make it very difficult to cite anything outside of it unless we look at how we're doing our land use planning for those communities. In addition, we have a robust state building codes and building officials program. I think some of this can be taken care of in that area as well. I think there is room for a larger, broader conversation so that all parties have a voice in the process. Back to Vice Chair Mona Sanderson's comments about the hospital, it was a very difficult decision for that community from what I've read. I mean, this is all, of course, now coming from news reports and not firsthand knowledge, obviously. But I've heard from our city managers down there that looking at all of the options for the hospital, price is a huge part of it, but also the needs of a hospital in the present versus the potential for disaster upon a tsunami, and not having any hospital in the county as a result of, you know, what an emergency vehicle has to go to, how far away is it if you're having a heart attack downtown, and it being the only hospital in the entire county, made it a very difficult decision for them and a difficult process for them to go through. And for a community like that to have a state agency come in and say, you know what, never mind, you don't get a hospital at all, that's problematic as well. So we as a league always put forward that the local decision-making process is probably paramount because we best know the needs of our communities. But when it comes to massive natural disasters like this, we want Dogami's expertise and consultation. We need the building codes division to be prepared and helping us in that same way, and DLCD with that pre-planning process to allow us to think about these sorts of things. All of those pieces need to occur before we make the final decision about how our communities look. And again, broader, I think with all of the bills looking at all the different types of natural hazards that exist in this state and having LCDC start working on that rulemaking, I know that there's at least one other bill, not just specific to tsunamis, that's broader in intention that I think is starting on the House side and is probably going to move to kind of concentrating our efforts there to start with will allow us to start at the beginning, which is planning. And for those reasons, we're happy to continue the long-term conversation on the concept behind Senate Bill 778, but would prefer to start at the land use point in time. Thank you.
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, my name is Greg Wasson. I have degrees in journalism, political science, and law from the University of Oregon, and for some reason I've spent the last 15 years researching, most of the last 15 years, researching the history of the Initiative Amendment and the Home Rule Amendment. The Home Rule Amendment would not allow this bill at all, the way it's written in the Constitution. I am at the risk of sounding arrogant, I probably understand more about the history of the Home Rule Amendment than anyone else alive. And I have grown disgusted in the last 15 years as I've watched my government write the Home Rule Amendment out of the Oregon Constitution. This bill would pass muster under the most recent Oregon Supreme Court decision. La Grande Astoria was really the seminal case, allowing the state to come into local government. But I would argue that that was a dry run by Hans Lindy in announcing the kind of limitations he wanted to put on the initiative process. If you go back to 1909, essentially the Home Rule Amendment would allow the city of Corvallis to write its own rules of what's a contract, and the city of Albany to write its rules of what's a contract. And in 1909, the Oregon Supreme Court said, well, yes, that's what it says, but the federal constitution prohibits the creation of a state within a state. So therefore, even though the Home Rule Amendment allows that kind of local control, the federal constitution will not allow it if the local decisions take on the characteristic of a state decision. Therefore, the distinction is, if it's a state issue, then the state can amend county or city charters. If it's a local issue, they can't. Right after World War I, there were 17 districts in Portland with the ability to tax, and they all did. So the legislature created a three-person committee appointed by the governor with the ability to reduce the tax budget approved by the people of Multnomah County. Three people could say, oh, you approve this budget? We have decided that the people of Multnomah County cannot do this. We're striking that budget. That bill came before the Oregon Supreme Court, and the Oregon Supreme Court said that that was okay, that local budgets were not local issues. That was 1921. 1936, the Oregon Supreme Court revisited the issue and reversed itself and said, no, local budgets are local issues, but none of the subsequent Supreme Court justices, or even the two experts, Otter and I don't remember the other person who had done the Home Rule, understood this. La Grande Astoria does not even cite Straw v. Harris, which is the only principled application of the Home Rule Amendment. So I just wanted to call attention to this committee that the legislature is ignoring the government. Not the legislature is doing what the Supreme Court says it can do. The government is ignoring the Home Rule Amendment, and I think it ought to be put back in, because I may run into my city council person at the grocery store. I might run into my state representative at the grocery store as well. In fact, I have. But the government that governs closest to the locality governs best. Somebody famous said that, but anyway, so.
Thank you, Jeff.
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, Jeff Rubin, Emergency Manager for Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue and Vice Chair for the State Resilience Task Force. I just wanted to offer a couple things in terms of the intent behind our recommendations as they relate to Senate Bill 778. We had made a specific recommendation that the Dogami Board of Governors adopt the new tsunami inundation maps. I think we specified the L maps. Based on the process that's already been set out, I think with Senate Bill 379 that our previous panel talked about, that's already been established. There are rules to do that. Another one of our recommendations was towards allowing cities greater flexibility in terms of urban growth boundary, both before disaster and afterwards, in terms of whether it was defining emergency reserves to facilitate recovery or simply being able to expand the UGB so that the choices are easier. You're not default in a inundation or other vulnerable zone. It's, you know, to a large extent, it's we're trying to go win-win. We strongly believe in a locally driven process. We occasionally end up with a lose-lose because it's recent and regional, using the OSO State Route 530 landslide. You know, that was a tragedy. What we don't want to get into, maybe it's unavoidable, is the tension between you can't tell me I can't build here, and then afterwards, why did you let me build here? That's about as succinctly as I can express it, but I'm happy to take questions. We, as with the previous panel, I take no specific position on 778. I think we're in general agreement. We want a better process, and particularly take advantage of some of the processes that already exist.
So a question for Jeff. I mean, so and city's the same thing. You just stated the same thing that we said earlier, which is the first step maybe is to get LCDC and the statewide rules that are put into place in terms of a way to go forward, because it's the latter, which whether you support home rule or not, we don't want the state as example, and we'll use the city. Hypothetically, a city or a county operates a hospital or a public entity, they build it in an inundation zone and it gets washed away. It's not the state legislature's responsibility to come back and figure out how to replace the thing because they knew they shouldn't have put it there to start with. Likewise, I see the same problem if, you know, the state goes, state highway department or anybody goes down to point fingers and build something in Newport Bay and it gets washed away, then, okay, there's not much we can do because we knew better, as you pointed out, and they shouldn't have done it. And the point there is, you know, an issue of who's going to pay for it in tax dollars. So I would ask the cities and you, Jeff, is, I mean, the first step is let's do the statewide or the coastal planning portion of the statewide planning through LCDC and then see if we can convince agencies to be more receptive.
And we recognize that when we made our recommendations that while we ultimately wanted to see the new inundation maps adopted, you know, using that best available science clause, that that was not going to be an immediate process. And as an interim option as well as just a general concept, we wanted the cities to have the option. You don't have to wait for a state action to make your own decisions on how you want to handle development. I mean, I agree, it is land use planning is an essential part of that. It's one of the most effective ways of mitigating natural hazards.
Okay. Any comments?
No further comment.
I'm sure, Greg, you don't want to pay for the state to put two buildings out on the coast either.
Well, no, except, you know, if the people in Gold Beach are so stupid that they want to build a hotel in a tsunami center, I say let them.
Oh, that's it. Questions, members? Anything else? Is there anyone else that wants to testify on 778?
Oh, good.
So you're going to come up then. All right.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Legal Women Voters of Oregon, I simply want to say, as you had this discussion, Peggy Lynch. I did say Peggy Lynch, Legal Women Voters of Oregon, really quickly. I really wanted to encourage whatever you decide to do on these series of bills and this particular issue. One of the important things is that the public needs to be brought along. So the opportunity with doing DLCD rulemaking, the opportunity to have these conversations here in your building related to these bills is a really important part, because unless the people understand the consequences and can weigh them, it will be much more difficult for them to change their local community plans and their development codes to address what is truly going to be a sad disaster in Oregon. So thank you for holding these hearings, and I'm hoping that should you move a bill forward, that it includes a robust public outreach and opportunity to have those conversations. Thank you.
Any questions? Okay, colleagues, that we're going to close the public hearing on SB 778. Colleagues, we're pretty much done for the day. 94 and 1, 2, or 3 of its portions we're going to schedule for next week. I do need feedback of who's interested in those amendments. 808 will be scheduled next week with the dash one amendments. SCR 12, as I told Mr. Westham, Windham, will be scheduled for next week. And then we're going to reach out and see if we can close the loop finally on 775 of whether people, there is a liability, there isn't a liability, and I suppose even is there a liability of building a state place in the bottom of the water. So with that, colleagues, I look forward to your input in the next couple of days. We are done for the day. Till next week.